Our next case is State v. Ostrom. State v. Ostrom.
I would like to reserve the right to rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is Brett McArthur. I represent the appellant Russell Ostrom in this matter. This case arises out of a conviction for a misdemeanor assault. Mr. Ostrom was convicted after a bench trial of assaulting his girlfriend, Ms. Craig. The only evidence supporting the conviction was a hearsay statement by Ms. Craig's father that was allowed into evidence over our objection. Originally, the court sustained the objection on a couple of occasions. And after proffering the evidence, I think perhaps a third time the court overruled our objection, the evidence was then convicted. A brief summary of what happened factually. Mr. Ostrom came home from work, and there was nobody in the house. There was a mess. He was unhappy. Some hours later, Ms. Craig came home. She had been drinking. The testimony was that she was intoxicated. An argument ensued, and a neighbor lady or a friend took an older child over to Ms. Craig's house, which was just outside the door and around the corner of the block and just down the street. She took the child and then came back. In the meantime, the argument continued, and Mr. Ostrom and Ms. Craig moved towards the door. There was a different testimony about what happened, but essentially, Mr. Ostrom told her she had to leave. And so as they were walking towards the door together, Ms. Craig proceeded out the door and fell down the steps. How she fell down the steps was what was really in controversy. That was alleged to have been the assault. Mr. Ostrom said he opened the door and that due to her intoxication, she was unsteady on her feet and that she fell. The hearsay statement implicated Mr. Ostrom and essentially pushed her out the door. And so that was really the crux of the case. The facts were nearly undisputed other than that. Mr. Ostrom indicated that Ms. Craig was intoxicated. She admitted she'd been drinking. She admitted that her memory every evening was not very clear. She indicated that when they walked towards the door, Mr. Ostrom had his arm around her and essentially released her. That was her testimony at trial. She didn't say at trial that she was pushed. She said that she went out the door and kind of face planted in the front yard, scraped her arm, and the wind was knocked out of her. She got up, Mr. Ostrom came outside, helped her inside. They went and sat on the couch. They talked for a while. And I think the evidence was that she had calmed down. The neighbor came back from delivering the older son to the father's house. She came back. They were still arguing a bit. And so it was decided that perhaps Ms. Craig was simply just leaving to go to her father's also because they were still not, they still had not fully resolved the argument. Mr. Ostrom said, you cannot take the younger son with you. He's staying here. He's staying there at the time. Ms. Craig was upset about that, but she left and went with her friend to her father's house, which was a few minutes away. The overall lapse of events, across the time lapse, from the time that Ms. Craig fell until she got back up, went back in the house, sat down. They talked for about 5 minutes. That was the testimony. The testimony was it was a few minutes walk from their house to their father's house. So it reasonably estimated this was an 8 to 10 minute event from the time that Ms. Craig fell until the time she arrived at her father's house. The evidence is undisputed that in between that time, they sat down, they talked, they had calmed down.
Did she admit to calming down?
I don't think she admitted to calming down.
That when she arrived at her father's, wasn't the evidence that she was still crying and upset?
Yes, that was. And, you know, that was evidence that, you know, my client wasn't clear, so I couldn't testify to that part of what happened. But the evidence wasn't, I think that's actually a quote, that she was still crying and upset. There was not a lot of detail or a lot of explanation as to how hard she was crying. If there was, you know, I spoke in the broad range of crying. It could be a tear coming down your cheek or it could be like your chest heaving and weeping sort of crying. There wasn't a lot of detail given. So we don't know a lot about the state of her emotion. But, and we also don't know what he meant by upset. He did use the word upset. We don't know if she was frantic out of her mind or if she was just, if upset was another word to describe crying. There's not a lot of detail, and that's a problem because, of course, the idea behind the exception for the excited utterance is that the person has to be speaking, making a statement from the shock and excited nervousness of the event. And so we don't know if her emotional state really rose to that level. I suspect it did not, because Ms. Craig did testify at trial that the reason she was crying was because she didn't like the way that Mr. Ostrom was talking to her, and she didn't like the fact that she had left her youngest child back in the house. And so our point on raising these objections in Fallon's appeal was, although we have an event that could have been startling at the beginning, there was an intervening period of time when they came back inside, when they were, by all accounts, sitting around talking. And there's a time lapse. There's a time lapse of probably about 10 minutes. Now, there is no cutoff period in how soon an excited utterance has to be made after the event, but 10 minutes seems like a pretty long stretch. And I think that the court can rely on Ms. Craig's testimony that the reason she was crying was not because that she had fallen down in the front yard. The injuries she sustained were relatively minor. She had a scrape on her arm and she had a little notch out of her. That does not seem like the type of event that is likely to cause someone 10 minutes later to still be able to issue an utterance without the ability to reflect on what happened.
Does this actually come down to whether or not
I think it does. I think it does.
What evidence is there was?
I think there's numerous things, Your Honor. First is that she was asked a question by her father. When Mr. Craig testified at the trial, he indicated that he asked her a question, what happened? And
the idea can still be found to be an excited utterance, even if it's in response. But
I think that the fact that a question is asked does not automatically preclude that. So the answer is yes, Your Honor. But I think that if we're going to weigh all the factors, when someone asks a question, I think that's one more weight on the side of it's not an excited utterance, because it does give rise to the idea that someone has to reflect and recall to respond appropriately to what we're being asked. So I acknowledge your point, but I still think that's a point in Ms. Ostrom's favor. So, and the other point is the 10-minute lapse in time, the fact that they sat down and talked, and just the fact that Ms. Craig said, I was crying because I left my child behind and I didn't like the way he was talking to me. And if you look at the overall circumstance, this does not appear to be the type of event where somebody's life was in danger, where it was a near-death experience, where somebody was being threatened with a weapon, or somebody suffered grave injuries. It's not the type of circumstance that would cause one to think that 10 minutes later, after he's gone inside to sit down and talk, that you would still be speaking without the ability to reflect 10 minutes later. It just doesn't seem like those types of facts. And really, the concern here, and in my estimation, the danger of this case is that if this judgment is allowed to stand, it will create a precedent that every time somebody makes a statement when they're having an emotional response, and clearly she was exhibiting some level of emotion, we don't dispute that, but an emotional response is not the same as an excited utterance under the legal definition. And my concern is that this says that that someone who gives a response while they're emotional, that's gonna trump someone's right to have to confront the witness against them, irregardless of the intervening causes for the emotion, irregardless of the time frame, irregardless of the magnitude or lack thereof of the event which gave rise to it in the first place. And so I think that should be a great concern here, that essentially someone crying was enough to trump my client's right to confront the witness against them. So that's all the comments I have. Is there any more questions?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May I report to you all on behalf of the applicant, State of Nebraska. What was signed on error is the claim that the statement of the victim in the particular case is not contemporaneous with the excited utterance. On my reading of the record, she arrived at her father's house about 3 months after the assault. And as the court said in Hale.
Well, wasn't there also a five-minute discussion? Call it on the couch.
You mean before she went to her father's
right.
house?
Yeah. So it's assault.
But I don't think 8 minutes, if I may, Your Honor, sorry, I don't think 8 minutes is the issue. The issue is not that. It's whether they're under the stress of the event. And she arrived at her father's house, she's crying in pain and upset. That's the foundational requirement for side 11. Therefore, the county court's decision was admitted under the side 11. It's not clearly erroneous, supported by the record. As far as the application of law, it does not have to be contemporaneous. It's only that the facts show that the excited utterance is under the stress of the startling event. Therefore, the county court was correct in its admissibility, and the district court was correct in affirming the county court on appeal that it was an excited utterance.
What do you think the best evidence is for your position? This was an excited utterance based upon the assault. As opposed to being upset that her child was like a child. When she went to her father's.
I don't know that, that's a distinction with meaning, Your Honor, because if she's under the if she's under stress, if you're saying she left her son behind and the assault didn't stress her out at all, I don't know what you might base that upon.
The question is whether at the time she made the statement, because she didn't have an opportunity to react to the place, and that she was upset because of the assault. Thankfully, I understand the argument is that she coming down, you know, like you would know, have happened, falling down when that was supposed to be. And that what she was really upset about when she left the house, the fact that she didn't get back to the house. She didn't take the younger child with her. That's what she's upset about. That's what she's talking about. I'm not sure that's sufficient.
Having laid the foundation for the exception, Your Honor, I think that becomes a question of fact, whether the fact point as to whether or not she was upset. And it certainly is supported by the record, therefore, it's not clearly erroneous. The fact that it was contemporaneous, it doesn't need to be contemporaneous, and the fact that she was upset and her statement was shortly after the event. Now, I don't know, there is not a minute. Or 2 minutes, or a case saying that 3 minutes or 5 minutes was too long. If you look at State v. Plant, that was the next day. Now, granted, State v. Plant has been overruled on other grounds. The fact of the matter is, that it wasn't the stress of the event is still there. That's what's going on here. And that is the question for the trier of fact and a foundational aspect of life. Laying the foundation for the exception to the hearsay rule. That's basically what the trier of fact found, Your Honor, and the court also found that the record supported that. So sitting as an appellate court, this court is to review the decision for clear error. There is no clear error.
The factual question should have been admissible.
That's correct. But I would suggest, respectfully suggest to the court on the question of de novo reviewing the application of facts to the law. The law supports the county court and the county court's finding that it need not be contemporaneous and that the foundation is properly laid. And that, frankly, in matter, I don't think you can draw the distinction between the two. How do you know one is the cause of the other? We don't. So, with that, Your Honor, I also pointed out in brief that the assignment of error with respect to the directed verdict and the sentence is not really before this court. On
wasn't the long form complaint in the record?
Yeah, but I could not find. Yes, Your Honor, I could not find any case law reported that the. Well, you say long form, I guess, in the sense that, yes, it wasn't correct. That's correct. But I don't know that, I don't know that long form complaint is all of the elements or
correct.
Cases that say it's a long form complaint.
I would certainly be interested in that, Your Honor, because I did not find any that said that. If there is one, I'll certainly stand corrected. But I think that the case law is very clear from the Supreme Court that the only way that you get to review, it's the ordinance rule, and it's been there, it's been there.
Did State versus Hill say complaints in the record?
You found that, Your Honor? I did not. I certainly would acknowledge that. And if that's true, nonetheless, the directed verdict says that the only evidence supporting the case was the hearsay exception. Having shown the hearsay exception or the statement was admissible, the directed verdict conversely was properly overruled. As far as the sentence goes, perhaps we should have best judgment and remand it for a jail sentence. Because I don't see how a sentence of probation is excessive. So with that, I will send it.
Thank you.
He has a minute, 5 seconds.
Can we go back to the issue of whether it was a conscientious objection and whether that she was upset because of the alleged assault or whether she was upset because of leaving the property?
Certainly, Your Honor, those are factual determinations. Clearly.
And the court made a determination that in this particular case, the statements were a result of a fault. And what does that mean?
That leaves the court to search the records for any evidence that that was in fact the case in the record.
Backing up one step further, did the county court actually make a factual finding?
No, they didn't. There is no evidence in the record that she was crying as a result of the fall. The only person who knows why she was crying is her. And she said it's because I didn't like the way he was talking to me and I left without my child. That's the only facts in the record.
However, when asked by her father what had happened, didn't she immediately proceed to talk about essentially what that was for?
She did. But she didn't say that's why.
Does it have to be why?
I think that one of the elements of the cited utterance is that the statement must be made while under the stress of the event. And I don't think that there was showing that there was sufficient stress at the event. It was given the inability to reflect, so if I may just respond to part two of your question, I don't think that there is a reasonable inference that she was still under stress of the event, such as that she did not have time to reflect, because the undisputed evidence was they went back in the house and they talked. They were reflecting, they were talking about things, they were having a conversation. And just the length of time, I mean, it must have been 10 minutes by the time they got there. This was not the type of event that would cause someone to be in a state of shock. But that was not the evidence. The only thing that the bottom line was crying and she was upset. He didn't say she was screaming or beside herself. It just wasn't that kind of scenario. So I don't think the evidence is sufficient to find that there was that she was under the stress of the fall, because she didn't say that. She said, I was crying because the other things we have.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Council
of Justice. Thank you, Your Honor.